You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 26th of October 2020 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist. I'm Emma Nelson and a very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up, China maps its future as the Communist Party's Central Committee meets to decide its economic plan for the next 5 years. We'll examine the paths it could take. Also ahead, the UN calls it an important turning point towards peace and stability. But how long will Libya's ceasefire really last? Then our series on the upcoming US election today, an explainer on voting and the Electoral College.
This year in particular, things are different because we're seeing a huge increase in the number of people voting by mail or voting early in person.
All that plus Monday's newspapers and a weekly dose of good news too. That's all coming up on The Globalist, live from London. First, a quick look at what else is happening in today's news. A national state of emergency has been declared in Spain to help control a new spike in COVID-19 infection rates. Chileans have voted to change their constitution to replace a version written during the dictatorship of General Augusto Pinochet. And the Australian city of Melbourne is to exit lockdown. It's recorded no new COVID cases for the first time since June. Stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on these stories. But first, China's financial future, or its next 5 years at least, will be mapped out this week as the Communist Party's Central Committee meets to create the country's economic blueprint until 2025. Known as a plenum, the aim of the meeting is to make the world's second largest economy a little more self-sufficient. Well, to tell us more, I'm now joined by Sophia Yan, who's a Telegraph's correspondent in Beijing. Welcome, Sophia. Good to have you back.
Good morning to you.
Just remind us, what is the plenum?
Well, this is a meeting of the Central Committee of China's ruling Communist Party. And so it's a meeting that lasts pretty much all week, led by party leader Xi Jinping. And it happens now because they're trying to make plans to develop a blueprint for the next 5 years. So we're talking about economic and social policy goals for the entirety of China. And these are really pretty intense goals to be making at a time when there's so much uncertainty, obviously, with the pandemic. There are rising geopolitical tensions, especially between the U.S. and China. And really, what they are targets. They give us a sense of where China would like the country to be heading, what direction to be going in. And setting those policy goals down on paper in this plan that we expect to come out means that then the Communist Party really has no room for error. They're going to have to meet the goals that they have set out for themselves.
Now, all of this happens behind closed doors. So what sense do we get about what is planned?
Well, there's likely to be some discussion about how to incorporate a major climate change target that Xi Jinping announced recently. He pledged that China would be carbon neutral by 2060. And so all these policymakers who've been thinking about how to plan and develop this country of 1.4 billion people, they're going to have to figure out how to incorporate this target and what plans might help them reach that goal. The other big challenge, of course, is the economy. With the virus, a lot of things have been in flux in China, of course, also elsewhere in the world. And even though experts think China remains on track to become the world's largest economy in the next few years, surpassing the U.S., that doesn't mean that they don't have challenges in the near term to be able to overcome. A lot of those are structural issues, trying to move away from the old growth model, which was focused mostly on manufacturing and exports, to one that's more driven by consumerism and the services economy. And so with COVID, what China has been doing in terms of stimulating the economy has been more of that old growth model, investing a lot in infrastructure, for instance. And that gives some relief in the short term, better jobs, more jobs that are available. But in the long term, that doesn't necessarily move them toward this more consumer-oriented economy. So in the long term, China really needs to think about these more painful changes that the government will have to implement.
There is this feeling that China needs to be more self-reliant, isn't there? And there's the idea of what's described as dual circulation, which is the president's description of what's saying, you know, you make your domestic economy a lot more solid, much more self-reliant, but you get help from external trade. I mean, how much of a departure is that?
Well, this idea of being more self-reliant has been on the books for quite some time. A few years back, China put out a policy, Made in China, this whole plan to develop more advanced manufacturing capabilities. And so that was really to move away from relying on external trade partners for technology and for services that it has typically in the past looked to outside trade partners for. And the idea is to really steeped in more national security and for a greater chance to develop further as a country. Of course, that has been put on hold in some ways with all, again, the uncertainty that China's facing with the pandemic. And in many ways, trying to get back to this idea and making that a priority to be more self-reliant is really important because of all the geopolitical tensions that Beijing is now facing. This U.S.-China relationship, definitely on rocky territory, the same with Australia, with Canada, with the EU, it's starting to sort of be recalibrated in terms of how the EU is looking toward to how it wants to engage with China. And so trying to be able to stand on its own two feet solidly is going to become more and more important for China.
It would mean that China would actually have to make enough for it to be, you know, so that local consumption would be big enough. Sorry, local manufacturing would and production would be enough to satisfy the great Chinese love of consumption. How realistic a prospect is all this, given the events of the last year or so?
Well, a lot of easier to make goods, things like face masks. That's a great example for this year. I mean, China supplies much of the world, so it already makes enough to satisfy domestic demand, also enough to supply for international demand. But it's really sort of this advanced side of technology where things are more of an issue and more of a challenge for China. For instance, engines, they've always had an issue with that. And that's important for the military. Also from a commercial perspective, that's also important. So they've often looked to foreign technology for those kinds of items, for those goods, and trying to develop that on its own has been difficult. There's a lot of discussion about whether or not China possesses the creativity and the innovation to be able to do that. Right now, they're still relying for a lot of their military, for the planes and all the different tanks and all these things that they have. For the PLA, a lot of this still does rely on foreign technology. And so this is one big hurdle that China has been for many years trying to overcome and still has a bit of a way to go.
One thing that we never, ever know is what China's real GDP growth is per year. We get given numbers and we're assumed that they're correct, but you know, there's never that amount of evidence. I mean, how ambitious can the Chinese now be in the next couple of years?
Well, that really remains to be seen. The first quarter of this year, we had a really big contraction that we saw out of China, 6.8% contraction. I mean, that's almost a direct reversal of the amount of growth that the country saw for the whole of last year. Now, as the year has gone on, each quarter subsequent from the first, it's improved. 3.2% growth in the second quarter, and then 4.9% growth in the third quarter. And so that's growth that for many countries, they'd be overjoyed to have, especially this year with the uncertainty of the pandemic. But again, going forward, there's a lot of structural changes that need to occur. And without that, while on the numbers front, it looks good, it's not. The issues that are underlying haven't really been dealt with. And that has been something that economists have talked about now for many, many, many years. A lot of this, for instance, relies on trying to turn around state-owned enterprises. They call it sort of the iron rice bowl. You get a job with this SOE, you have it forever. I mean, they're just really large, inefficient conglomerates, essentially. They're not always adding value to the economy. And until China can really move away from this model that it's always relied on, it's hard to see how growth can really be sustained very well into the future. I mean, again, the numbers can look good, but that doesn't mean what's supporting the numbers that we're seeing is necessarily the right way to be going for China.
Let's move on to the current virus outbreak in Xinjiang. What's happening there?
Yes, well, this has just blown up over the weekend. And this is definitely something that Xi Jinping, as he presides over this week's meeting, was going to have to think about. I mean, making plans for the next 5 years is difficult enough. But then with all the things that can happen unexpectedly in the midst of a pandemic, of course, you can imagine that the challenge is even more difficult. So there was one asymptomatic case found on Saturday, a 17-year-old who worked at a garment factory in Xinjiang. And this is the far western province in China. It borders Central Asia, landlocked. home to many Uyghurs, an ethnic Muslim minority that has suffered from oppression in other ways because of their traditions, of their religion. And so ever since that first case was found on Saturday, mass testing has begun. There have been a number of other cases found at the same factory that this one woman worked at. Her parents and her brother actually returned negative results, but then at her parents' factory, their colleagues also, there were a number of asymptomatic cases. And so Kashgar now, there's mass testing that authorities have unleashed. This is part of the emergency response that China has now fine-tuned after having dealt with a number of these surprise cluster outbreaks. And also transport links are getting shut down. And so we're going to likely see in the next few days what we've seen unfold in other parts of China when these cluster infections and local transmissions have occurred, which again begins with mass testing and then very detailed contact tracing, quarantines when necessary, and then really a mini lockdown of sorts where things in that area will shut down until the virus situation improves.
I mean, what you've just described suggests that there is a very strong handle on this situation by the authorities. I mean, is there that sense that people do feel as if the Chinese authorities can control the COVID-19, any resurgence in infections, but without having to make the whole country go into lockdown?
Well, China's had a lot of experience. In fact, really the most experience with dealing with COVID, having been the first country to find infections all the way back at the start of the year. So this sense that they've got it somewhat under control, it is there. There is a sense that they are able to deal with these surprise infections, but it is pretty heavy-handed. The contact tracing, for instance, is pretty invasive. And even though this is an authoritarian state, people here are pretty used to doing what they're being told to do. It doesn't mean that there isn't sort of some private grumbling here and there about all the ways you're being tracked. I mean, to enter stores, for instance, typically requires having to download the local provincial government's contact tracing mobile app. So you would scan a code to enter, and that would allow the shopkeepers to know whether or not you are essentially healthy enough to come in, whether or not you had come in contact with someone, for instance, who had tested positive recently, or if you had traveled to an area that was experiencing this one of these surprise cluster outbreaks. And so because of that, yes, it's a strategy that has been effective, but again, it can be pretty heavy-handed at times.
Sophia Yang in Beijing, thank you for joining us on Monocle 24.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle 24's 30-minute weekly conversation with inspiring business leaders from around the world, uncovering the secrets of resiliency and growing a company and the many definitions of success.
How many times have you had a great idea for a brand that you kind of go, that would work? And then you sit down and a month later, you go, that would really work, actually. And then you ask yourself that very simple question, do I want to spend every day owning a brand new innovative picnic blanket brand? And you're like, no, I don't want to do that.
I've had to learn how to adjust my management style and frankly, learn to be a CEO.
I think in your standard entrepreneurial journey, there's a lot of times when you might want to throw in the towel. But if impact is really at the heart of what you do, you don't have that option. You have to stick to your guns.
Join me, Daniel Bache, for a new episode of The Entrepreneurs every Wednesday at 20:00 London time, right here on Monocle 24.
We'll have the first in our explainer of the US election coming up a little bit later, plus Andrew Muller will tell us some good news. But first, a deal for a permanent ceasefire in Libya has been agreed. The UN's mission in the country said the agreement was signed on Friday between the Government of National Accord, based in Tripoli, and its rivals, led by the renegade General Khalifa Haftar. The UN calls it an important turning point towards peace and stability in Libya, but how long will it last? Well, let's join Anas El-Ghamati now, who's the founder and director of the SADC Institute, a non-governmental think tank based in Libya. Welcome to the programme, Anas. Just explain to us what happened on Friday.
Thank you. So there has been an agreement for a permanent ceasefire, but there is nothing substantive yet in this deal that indicates any different to previous attempts. Now, it's been lauded as historic, but there was a historic peace deal that was achieved in Berlin in January, and those talks fell apart within days, ultimately, but formally by March. So it's quite aspirational. I mean, the two sides have agreed to, in principle, open the airports together and enter travel within Libya or intercity travel within Libya. The oil ports are now going to open so Libya can begin to pump and sell oil once again. But the really substantive matter is the two areas really that divide the Libyan population, the ideological ambitions of Khalifa Haftar and his self-styled Libyan National Army, but also the idea of who and who is not worthy of holding a weapon and what kind of combination of government they will hold, those things have not been agreed. And so there are many, many things that have been pushed to a later date. A later date that I might add may actually come at a time when they need to discuss these matters, but they've already agreed in some semblance that the international recognition of one government will now apply to both governments. Now, if that is going to be the case, there is a very, very serious danger of a return to conflict, as has been the case not only in the last year, but really since 2016. But if that is the case and both sides are internationally legitimate, it's going to be very difficult to find a way or a mechanism to return them away. So I think there's nothing that gives me any indication of optimism, neither locally speaking, but also internationally, because it was the arms embargo violations that led to this renewal of conflict in March. And there's nothing that has changed internationally, at least not according to my knowledge, that would give me optimism that the UN can stop international actors such as Russia, the UAE and Egypt, who have intervened on the side of Khalifa Haftar, from returning again to ship the very weapons in that were used to violate and break the last ceasefire.
We'll come to international involvement in a moment, because it is absolutely key in all this. But just could you just recap why we are where we are at the moment? It is, what, nearly 10 years since the NATO-backed revolt toppled General Gaddafi. There has been very little sense of peace since then, has there?
Between 2011 and 2013, Libyans went to the polls. They went twice. The first turnout was hugely successful. And there was a period of relative calm and relative stability. But, you know, this is always going to be the case. It's always going to be relative calm and relative stability, given that the country had so many weapons in it. But I would say that there are these political lightning rod moments. Now, these are the moments where it's not just a small skirmish in a neighborhood or between a city, but it's national level mobilization. What is the reason that Libyans across the country seem to pick up weapons and then mobilize and join forces nationally? These lightning rod moments come when they're threatened existentially by either the return of authoritarianism or the extension of authoritarianism. So that was in 2011 when Libyans across the country indeed picked up weapons and were supported by a NATO-backed campaign. But again in 2019, a week away from a national conference that would have, you know, pitted Libyans together and put them in a room to discuss their differences, Khalifa Haftar launched an offensive on the capital to overthrow the UN-backed government, a power grab, essentially, and a return to military rule. And Libyans know what that seems like. They know what that is. They've experienced that for 40 years. So they mobilized nationally and stopped it. And I think these moments are the reasons why. I mean, we can always go through the names of different governments, the names of different individuals, but at its heart, there is something there that triggers Libyans to act literally so violently, because they pick up weapons and they refuse to put them down until that threat is extinguished. And I think it's a repeat of those scenarios. It happened in 2011. It arguably happened again in 2014. It's happening since 2019. And I shudder that it could happen again. But after the process of the UN has reassigned international legitimacy to actors that right now, especially Khalifa Haftar's Libyan National Army, they're being investigated for war crimes. And I mean, to reward that group and to give that international legitimacy when its behavior is anything but, I think is dangerous. I think both sides now probably don't require any further international legitimacy until there's a semblance of justice that has been, you know, that has been dished out and some accountability measures and a brand new neutral army, not an army that seeks political power, but an army that is subservient to military power, is built. And the rush to do this is astonishing. I mean, they arrived in at midnight in Geneva, and by the morning they were issuing statements of a permanent ceasefire, and it was called historic. I mean, that wasn't enough time to have breakfast, so I'm surprised that they got to so much work within a few hours.
Let's talk about this international involvement, which seems to be so key to all this. The deal calls for the departure of all foreign forces from Libyan soil within 3 months. How are you going to tell this to the Russians and the Emiratis and all those who have been involved in supporting both sides?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Turkey again is involved on the GNA side. They've signed formal agreements transparently. They've got parliamentary approval in Turkey. They've had presidential approval, but on the Egyptian side, the Emirati side, or especially the Emirati and Russian side, those have been done, you know, concealed, discreetly, without real knowledge about the numbers. I mean, we go on the basis of UN reports, but essentially what seems to have irked really the Americans that are leading this and spearheading the efforts to get Libyans to a deal, is that Russian mercenaries, around 1,000, were documented and filmed literally departing from Tripoli's front lines in May and made their way to just south of Sirte, where the current stalemate is, where the permanent ceasefire will take place. And that has irked, you know, a number of European powers, but especially the Americans, who are looking at NATO's southern flank. So the southern belly, the edge of NATO's flank towards North Africa and the southern Mediterranean, which is facing Libya. And that's a place now where there is a key buildup of military or even quasi-military forces, because the problem with Wagner is not that there are these Russian mercenaries that have arrived into Libya. It's not that they're an army. It's that they're actually not an army. It's that they don't wear badges. They don't adhere to normal combat behavior. They don't have any kind of transparency. We don't know how many they are. We don't know how they operate. And that is really getting up the back of the Americans, who are now desperate to get a deal that resorts and responds to that phenomena. And I think the short-sightedness of that is pushing out, you know, Russian mercenaries from Sirte and getting, you know, some relief for internationals whilst not dealing with the very issues that led Libyans to a war that then brought in international mercenaries. I don't think that's stable. I don't think that's sturdy. And it doesn't give much, you know, semblance of any optimism for the future. I think it's helping international problems on Libya, but not helping Libyan problems on Libya.
Anas Al-Ghamati, thank you for joining us on Monocle 24. Still to come, we head to Vienna to take a close look at how it is responding to the coronavirus pandemic.
This has created a kind of twisted reality, where what you see on the news hardly corresponds with what you see on the streets, especially in the countryside outside Vienna, where life continues largely as before.
We'll hear more from Alexei Korolev later on in the programme. You're listening to The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
In Vienna, 722 here in London. Poland's highest court has ruled that the only circumstances in which a woman may have an abortion is in the case of rape, incest, or if there is a threat to the mother's life. The EU has reacted swiftly, saying such a decision is tantamount to a ban on terminations and as such a violation of human rights, which could put women's lives at risk. Well, to tell us more, we cross over to Warsaw now to join Johanna Pluczynska, who's a political journalist for Reuters. Welcome back to the show, Johanna.
Thanks for having me.
So explain to us, how did we get to this point where the Polish Supreme Court was voting on abortion rights?
So abortion has been a debate that's been ongoing in Poland for many years now, and it's not the first time that we're seeing women on the streets protesting limiting abortion rights in Poland. But the accusation is that the Polish government, the ruling nationalists, decided that it should be ruled on through the courts and not through the parliament, because it would potentially limit broader discussion about this. Now, of course, the ruling government has not said that, but that is the accusation from opposition activists, that by avoiding a public debate in parliament on this, this just kind of sets the decision in stone by taking it through the courts.
And the reaction has been pretty clear this weekend. We've seen protesters disrupting church services. We've had sit-ins. It's being very clear what many women think.
Yeah, absolutely. I think every single day since the decision was made, there have been thousands of people on the streets in all parts of Poland, not just in Warsaw. And I think the protests are expected to continue this week.
Tell us a little bit more about how the government has responded to this.
I think the government is defending the stance, and they're saying, you know, this is a decision by a court and it carries weight. And I think, you know, this confirms a lot of the socially conservative values that the Law and Justice Party that's in charge in Poland has been seeking to confirm since it came to power in 2015.
Just tell us a little bit more about, some are saying that so many protests having been held in churches, I think many protesters were staging sit-ins at Sunday Mass and what have you. And it's suggested that the Catholic Church is far too involved in government policy in Poland. Could you explain that for us?
So the ruling Law and Justice Party does have a very close relationship with the church. The Catholic Church in Poland, in many ways, is more conservative than the Vatican, and it really has been kind of the pinnacle of confirming socially conservative values on issues such as abortion, but also on other issues such as civil partnerships for LGBT people. So the church really does play a key role in kind of helping to confirm this worldview that the Law and Justice Party has been trying to confirm as well through its time in power. And I think that's why people went to church on Sunday and protested, because they felt that the church is a key part of this decision, that this is an institution that really works hand in hand with the ruling party.
One thing that people have suggested is that the European Union must step in more clearly here, insofar as if it is seen as an attack on women's rights, it must act against one of its member nations.
Absolutely. But unfortunately, as we've seen with the European Union, these things take a long time. And I think that the European Union hasn't taken strong action in a lot of other cases. I mean, the debate on the rule of law is still ongoing in the EU. There's constantly discussions about how to place limitations on Poland. But I think the government has a sense that not a lot of concrete action has actually been taken. And I would say many critics say that the consequences from the European Union don't seem to be swift or strict enough.
Indeed. I mean, look, Poland has got a track record of having long-running disputes with the EU about attacks on judicial independence, human rights, the freedom of the press. At what point do you think that there will be intervention by the European Union? Or is there just an acceptance in Poland that the EU will take action, but it is indeed too slow and rather ineffective?
I mean, there was a discussion, there is an ongoing discussion in the European Union about linking issues, not just rule of law, but also anything that violates the treaties with EU funding. And I think that's a discussion that will continue for quite some time. This was something we saw with the whole discussion this summer about the LGBT ideology free zones, if there was a way to cut funding from the European Union to those areas that declare themselves LGBT ideology free. And I think, you know, this issue of abortion will also be part of that broader debate. So I'm sure the European Union is likely to continue to discuss this, to vocally condemn it, and to try to find a way to take action. But it's just a matter of when that will happen and with what strength that will happen.
Joanna Pluczynska in Poland, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the line from Warsaw. You're listening to Monocle 24. It is now just over a week until Americans will have finished casting their votes in the most consequential US election in generations. To look ahead, every day this week we hear from an all-star cast of experts to dig a little deeper behind the stories dominating the headlines and the Twitter feeds and give us some crucial context on the key issues behind this year's race. First up, former US diplomat and partner at Signum Global Advisors, Lew Lukens, gives those not living stateside a helping hand on getting to grips with the US voting system, from how the votes are cast, to the Electoral College, to the all-important swing states. We get granular on the democratic process.
People are often confused about how voting works in America, and also about whether anything is different this year. So the reason people are confused about that is because it is confusing in America. There is no national American Electoral Commission, so every state has its own rules, every district has different rules. This year in particular, things are different because we're seeing a huge increase in the number of people voting by mail or voting early in person. Many Americans will actually go to the polls on election day itself to vote, however. Where in America, most precincts set up voting in school and church halls, polling locations are staffed by volunteers, and usually each party will have an observer at each location to make sure that nothing strange is happening. The Electoral College confuses a lot of people, too.
16 days to election day, and here is the biggest question. Can Donald Trump change this map? Can Donald Trump find a path to victory, meaning a path to 270 electoral votes?
This is an election that is won in battleground states. It's a race for 270 electoral votes. And I think one thing...
The Electoral College is enshrined in the Constitution. It gives each state a slate of electors based on the number of senators, so two from each state, plus the number of congressional representatives. That totals 538 electors, and therefore a candidate needs 270 to win. Every state except for two give all their votes to the winner of the popular vote in that state. The Democratic and Republican parties in every state will have a slate of electors ready to go. So, for example, if Joe Biden wins in Michigan, the 16 Democratic electors will go to the Electoral College and submit 16 votes for him.
And we know Joe loves coming to Michigan. He's been here so many times.
If Donald Trump wins in Michigan, the 16 Republican electors will go to the Electoral College and submit Michigan's 16 electoral votes for Trump.
We brought you a lot of car plants, Michigan. We brought you a lot of car plants. You know that, right?
The Electoral College is controversial for a number of reasons. First, it gives voters in more rural, unpopulated states greater weight. Without getting too technical or mathematical, if the average American vote is worth 100%, a vote in California is worth about 85%, while a vote in Wyoming is worth over 300%. So this leads to the situation that we've seen in a couple of recent elections, including 4 years ago, where almost 3 million more Americans voted for Hillary Clinton than for Donald Trump, yet Donald Trump won the presidency based on the Electoral College votes.
I wasn't supposed to get 222. They said there's no way to get 222. 230 is impossible. 270, which you need, that was laughable. We got 306.
If you look at our recent history, we've had several candidates, nominees, who have won the popular vote and lost the Electoral College. What does that say? And it says that an anachronism that was designed for another time no longer works. I think it needs to be eliminated.
Of all the 50 states in America, you'll hear a lot of conversation during an election about swing states and what states are particularly important. Based on polling right now, 24 states will likely vote for Joe Biden and 21 for Donald Trump. Five states are truly toss-up states. They're too close to call right now. Those are Ohio, Georgia, North Carolina, Florida, and Iowa. Biden is polling solidly ahead in some of the states that used to be considered swing states, including Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, states that surprised everyone 4 years ago by going for Donald Trump.
CNN now projects that Donald Trump will carry the state of Wisconsin. He will win Wisconsin with its 10 electoral votes. He's cracked the so-called...
Now, if those 24 states do indeed vote for Joe Biden, he will have won 290 Electoral College votes, and he will have won the election. So even if Trump wins the five true toss-up states, that's not enough for him to win. He would also have to win some of the additional states that he won 4 years ago, like the ones I just mentioned, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, where Biden is polling ahead, and states like Arizona, too. The states to watch election night are states that will be able to give results and that are key swing states. I would say Florida is the one to watch most closely. We expect Florida will announce results shortly after polls close. And if Florida goes for Joe Biden, the election is over at that point.
If we win Florida, you've won. You flat won.
Interestingly, Joe Biden is putting some states that are traditionally very Republican into play this year, including Georgia and Texas. That's partly due to changing demographics in those states, also a little bit due to Trump fatigue. Trump will likely still win those states, but the fact is he's being forced to spend money there to defend them.
There has never been a better time to be a proud Texan.
So once Americans have voted, how are votes counted? Again, every state has a different process, so it's a little bit complicated to get into. So what I would like to do is actually just give an example of two states, two neighboring states, Ohio and Pennsylvania, that are right next to each other and have very similar demographics, but are at opposite extremes. Ohio has had early in-person voting since October 3rd, as well as mail-in voting since earlier this month. Officials there have been able to open and process ballots since October 6th, so they will be ready to be counted on Election Day. And we think we'll know the results in Ohio shortly after polls close on November 3rd. Right next door in Pennsylvania, there is no early in-person voting. Voters are sending in mail-in ballots already, but officials may not open or process those ballots to check signatures, etc., until Election Day. So we don't think we'll have results in Pennsylvania for at least a couple of days after polls close on November 3rd. Biden is certainly ahead in the polls, and he's certainly ahead in the early voting that we've seen so far. But neither side can afford to take anything for granted. Hillary Clinton was ahead in the polls 4 years ago. So this election will come down to turnout, and we'll see what happens on Election Day, but people have to get out and vote.
And many thanks to the former US diplomat Lewis Lukens. Well worth listening once again on our podcast, I'd suggest. On tomorrow's series, we look at the impact of the Black Lives Matter movement on this year's race. Still to come, Monday's newspapers and the climate business news. But first, a quick summary of some of the other day's news headlines. A national state of emergency has been declared in Spain to help control a new spike in COVID-19 infection rates. The Prime Minister has also announced a curfew between 2300 and 6 a.m. is to be imposed nightly. Pedro Sanchez also said he'll ask Parliament to extend the new rules, initially in force for 15 days, to 6 months if needs be. Chileans have voted to change their constitution to replace the version written during the dictatorship of General Augusto Pinochet. A protest movement to rewrite it began a year ago. One of the conditions is that the new one be drafted by citizens instead of lawmakers. And the Australian city of Melbourne is to exit lockdown. It's recorded no new COVID cases for the first time since June. It's 111 days since travel restrictions were imposed and shops and restaurants were shut. 9 out of the 10 deaths in the second wave of infections had been in the state of Victoria. And those are the headlines on Monocle 24. Throughout this week on The Globalist, we take a closer look at how five of Europe's major cities have responded to the coronavirus pandemic. It comes as decision makers in the continent's corridors of power spin in different directions to try to control a second wave while keeping the economies afloat. So how are they getting on? Well, to usher in our series, Monocle's Alexei Korolev sent us this dispatch from the Austrian capital, Vienna.
There's a hackneyed old phrase that in Vienna, everything happens 50 years later. But that's not quite true when it comes to the pandemic. Having escaped the worst of it thanks to a robust response back in March and April, Austria is now quickly catching up with the rest of the world as its infection rate hits a new record every day. Still, Austrians have it relatively easy compared to other EU countries. A new rule of six was introduced on Friday, banning private indoor gatherings of more than six people. But beyond that, restaurants, bars, schools and theatres all remain open. This has created a kind of twisted reality, where what you see on the news hardly corresponds with what you see on the streets, especially in the countryside outside Vienna, where life continues largely as before. Though economic uncertainty persists, the government is determined to keep businesses running. That includes the now infamous Alpine ski resorts, that were the centre of one of the country's first outbreaks. But they're also a major lifeline for its tourist industry as the winter sets in. And while Austria's bureaucracy doesn't always make it easy for businesses to get support, help is there for those who can find it. A friend recently received several thousand euros in startup money for her podcast company. No easy task, even in normal times. Significantly, coronavirus was only a minor topic in this month's municipal elections in Vienna. Voters were much more worried about slow-burning issues such as street space, migration and the environment. Perhaps that's the kind of long-term thinking that has, so far at least, helped Austria overcome the worst ravages of this pandemic.
And my thanks to Monocle's Alexei Korolev there in Vienna. We'll have much more on Europe's response to coronavirus across the week here on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Globalist. The papers are up next. And to look at Monday's front pages, let's continue with Terry Stiasny, the political journalist and author and regular and welcome voice on Monocle 24. Good morning, Terry.
Good morning.
An astonishing story is broken in the United Kingdom in the last 24 hours involving a tanker, an oil tanker off the Isle of Wight and British special forces storming it. Obviously, the papers are all over it this morning.
Yes, that's right. This is the front page of many of the UK papers this morning, not surprisingly, because there was obviously high drama in the English Channel yesterday evening. But the more you read the stories, the less clear it is exactly what's happened. And I'm sure we'll find this out during the course of the day. So the Times' headline says that Special Forces storm oil tanker hijacked in the Solent off the Isle of Wight. The Daily Telegraph leads with Special Forces take control of ship after hijackers, in quotes, threaten the crew. It seems to be a question as to what extent the people on board the ship were hijackers. So they're believed to be around seven stowaways, and according to the Ministry of Defence, seven individuals have been detained. And it seems to be that once the stowaways were found on the ship, the crew members found them. According to the editor of Lloyd's List, the shipping journal, the crew tried to lock the stowaways in a cabin, but the situation became violent and the alarm was raised. And then what happened is that the police requested military assistance in the early evening at about 5 p.m. And as it happens, where this tanker was is very, very near, just off the Isle of Wight in the English Channel, near to Southampton and Portsmouth, and very near to naval bases and to the special boat squadron, the special forces. And apparently that once they were raised and got involved, it took them 9 minutes to get on board the ship and to detain the stowaways by what the Daily Telegraph called overwhelming force, and the crew are all safe and well. But I suppose what we don't know at the moment is whether these were stowaways who had any kind of, you know, more sinister intent, or whether they were just stowaways who were very unhappy to be found on the ship, and the crew became worried about this. You know, there is a good reason that the word hijack has been put in quotes by many of the papers.
Yes, there are lots of possible explanations to this, but what is not in doubt is the sort of poetic bravado with which the SBS, the Special Boat Service, sort of leapt into action, and the accompanying language that has been going with this. I mean, I've never heard the Defence Secretary, Ben Wallace, say things like, in dark skies and worsening weather, we should all be grateful for our brave personnel. People are safe tonight thanks to their efforts. People have sort of leapt into the derring do aspect of this story, haven't they?
Yes, I think so. I think particularly given the uncertainty about what was actually going on board the ship. Yes, the thing that we do know is that it took the SBS a very short time to get the situation under control. And obviously, this is the kind of thing, it almost sounds like the kind of training exercise that they would do, because their headquarters is fairly nearby in Dorset. And so what they are obviously trained to do this kind of thing. And we're told that the first Sea Lord, Admiral Tony Radakin, is understood to have taken personal responsibility for the mission. A frigate was deployed as backup. So, you know, this is the kind of the thing that they are supposed to do, and they obviously were able to do it very quickly. And yeah, it's a quick win for the Defence Secretary to be able to say that, you know, this is what the Special Forces do, and they do it well. The rest of the incident is a bit more unclear.
Let's move to El País. Spain is now going into a state of emergency.
Yes. But this, we're seeing obviously this across Europe, unfortunately, the sort of the second wave of coronavirus and growing numbers of cases around Europe. So Spain has brought in new powers. So extending what they're calling, what El País in its English translated version calls, a state of alarm for the country, and saying that there will be an obligatory curfew for the whole of Spain from 11 p.m. to 6 a.m. This is slightly apparently variable. So between region and region, you're allowed to have that slightly an hour, start an hour earlier or an hour later, but you will have to enforce the curfew overall. And it's also given the Spanish regions new powers to allow people to enter or to leave their regions unless it's for essential regions, essential reasons. And this is a power that the Spanish regions haven't had until now. And there's been an ongoing political row, really, between the central government and the regional governments as to what powers they should bring in. But this emergency, state of emergency, will be extended now until May and will no longer have to be approved every couple of weeks, as has been the situation before. But looking also in another article in El País, it does say that the case rates in Spain in some regions like Navarra and La Rioja and Aragon are very high. They're above 500 per 100,000. And so Spain is having to look at what more powers it can bring in, and how effective these are being, and whether this needs to be brought in more severe restrictions across the country.
Finally, looking at the Financial Times, a very interesting story about those who don't want to catch coronavirus from other passengers on regular commercial flights are switching to private jets.
Yes, this is fascinating. So some people, as with any crisis, some people will do well out of this, or at least relatively well. And according to the FT, yes, soaring numbers of wealthy flyers are switching to private jets to reduce the risk of catching coronavirus from other passengers on regular commercial flights. So if you're wondering how much this would cost, I mean, the number of private flights has dipped, but it's only gone down by 10% compared with the numbers of commercial flights, which have apparently halved. But so your average short-haul flight within Europe, if you fancy popping somewhere within Europe that will let you in at the moment, it's about €4,500, which I presume is for the whole plane, and I presume is just one way only. But apparently the key to this is using somebody else's empty leg of the flight. So if someone else has flown off somewhere nice and you happen to be in that nice place and wanted to go the other way, this will only cost you around €2,000. And again, I assume that's not per person. So, you know, if you have a lot of friends and a lot of money, I guess it starts to become rather more affordable. But as the MD of one of these private jet companies points out, it is not all optimism, because we just heard, obviously, about increased shutdowns again across the rest of Europe. He points out when somewhere is closed, it is closed for everybody. It doesn't matter if you come in on a private jet. So your options are still pretty limited.
Terry Stiasny, as ever, thank you very much for joining me on The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Let's join Akshat Rathi now, climate and energy reporter for Bloomberg News, to tell us the latest climate and energy news. Good morning to you, Akshat.
Good morning.
Good morning. An astonishing story coming out of Bloomberg, which is about a satellite which has now mapped the biggest methane emitters.
We've known for a long time that one of the biggest problems with climate change is we don't have real-time monitoring of greenhouse gases. The process takes a long time before companies or countries voluntarily tell you how much greenhouse gases they are putting out into the atmosphere and warming the planet. With satellite technology, we are finally getting to a point where we don't need to just rely on these voluntary reports, which are quite valuable, but we can also monitor them from the sky.
And it's an astonishing, it's an incredibly interesting map to read, not least because it charts the way that the early readings covered the lockdowns that aimed to slow the COVID-19 pandemic and the effect that it had on methane emissions.
Right. And methane emissions, as we know, are much more warming than carbon dioxide. And so soon we'll also have the opportunity to start monitoring carbon dioxide emissions, which form about 75% of the greenhouse gas problem we have.
Let's move on to Japan. It is now going to change the way that it produces energy.
Yes, just this morning we have confirmation from the Japanese Prime Minister that Japan will be aiming for net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. Which is a goal that it will match with the EU and, of course, the UK. And it is one of the largest consumers of coal to put forth this plan.
Tell us a little bit more about how it plans to do this.
So Japan has relied, because it's a small country, very ocean heavy country, has relied on importing most of its energy to power its power plants and to power its cars. Much of its electricity currently comes from coal, and is going to look to replace that with wind and batteries. That's likely going to be the mix that it will have to rely on if it has to cut its emissions to zero. Another technology it is backing is the use of hydrogen, which has been something it has worked on for quite a long time, but has yet to scale up.
So tell us a little bit about the way that it intends to do this. I mean, is the infrastructure in place?
The infrastructure is available. It's not yet in place. It's going to take a long time for it to be able to move away from what is a very coal-heavy mix to being able to build the sorts of wind farms that the UK and Northern Europe in general has been able to build, both onshore but mostly offshore, because Japan has a huge amount of ocean property it can access. And then it'll have to balance that out with batteries because, of course, the wind doesn't blow all the time.
And finally, a hydrogen mega project in Australia. What's that, Akshat?
So we've known of Australia as the place from where we get a lot of coal. Much of it ends up in China, some of it ends up in Japan, and a lot of metals and minerals. Of course, Australia is a huge continent and has a lot of land available to be able to dedicate itself to energy production. One of those things that it is doing through this hydrogen project is it's going to build out a huge amount of renewables. So this will be solar and wind, combine it with electrolyzers, which essentially split water into hydrogen and oxygen, and then use the hydrogen for energy. The nice thing about it is hydrogen burns cleanly. So it, again, combines only with oxygen and produces water, not adding to the greenhouse gas problem that we are facing.
So this is all called the Asian Renewable Energy Hub. It will use energy or electricity from wind and solar plants, and then it will then it was going to export it to the rest of the world. I mean, what timescale are we talking about here?
So this is looking to build a project by the end of this decade, 2028 to 2030. And you're right, the idea would be that Australia, as it is currently an exporter of energy, continues to be an exporter of energy to countries like Japan. Once the hydrogen is made in Australia, it will be then put onto ships and then moved around, just as we move around natural gas today. But the good thing is it's going to be a clean source of energy.
How much will this change the way that Australia is viewed by the rest of the world in terms of its energy? There's been an awful lot of criticism about last year when there were the huge forest fires, the huge fires. There was a great debate about Australia's continued reliance on fossil fuel and a sort of denial of climate change. Does this commitment to the Asian Renewable Energy Hub signify a change in direction in any way?
It does. We know that countries that have huge fossil fuel reserves tend to be countries that will then back those fossil fuel reserves because they are, of course, a source of great revenue. This has been the case with a lot of countries, including the US, as we've seen with this energy independence agenda. But what's happening now is that clean energy is getting cheaper, and that is having ramifications also politically. So Japan, when it set out its net zero goal today, said, you know, the prime minister said today very clearly that acting on climate change is now in our economic interests. And soon I think we'll start to see that sort of shift happening in Australia and hopefully Australian politics as well.
Akshat Rathi from Bloomberg News, thank you for joining us on Monocle 24. You're with The Globalist. Finally, to put a spring in your step with some more positive news stories, here's our very own Andrew Muller with this week's Good News Corner.
Welcome to the 30th of these weekly exercises in diving the mouldering shipwreck of the COVID-19 news cycle in the hope of locating the pirates' doubloons of good news before the oxygen runs out. As a grim winter looms, at least here in the Northern Hemisphere, it has at least been a pretty decent week for those of us who enjoy a news story, which seems to have been generated by plucking the key words from a lottery wheel. So in Belgium, mutant crayfish invaded a cemetery. This does appear to be a thing that has happened. Schoonselhof Churchyard in Antwerp has been overrun, it says here, by a self-cloning strain of marbled crayfish created by a laboratory breeding program, ideally, one hopes but has not checked, overseen by a wild-haired boffin with a chimpanzee sidekick. This also appears to be good news for genetically engineered auto-replicating crustaceans, and who is to say that they are not entitled to some meagre allotment of joy? That is not the limit, however, of this week's good news for creatures which live in ponds. Or perhaps we should say, good newts. To hell with you. There has been a long overdue change in luck for the lower water frog of Chile. As recently as last year, the global population of lower water frogs appeared to have been reduced to 14 bedraggled specimens huddled in one brackish puddle in the Atacama Desert. These were evacuated to Santiago Zoo, where, it has now been announced, they have between them furnished north of 200 tadpoles, giving the lower water frog a valuable jump start. Everyone's a critic. Returning to the subject of experiments about which nobody asked what could possibly go wrong, this is a callback to the freak plague of necrophile Belgian lobsters we met earlier, pay attention. There is good news from the Czech Republic for people who have COVID-19 but have wearied of the view of their own walls or the company of their household. A new hotel in Prague is dedicating itself to COVID-positive guests, offering a safely contactless experience and lavish in-room entertainment options. There may be listeners already aware of the hotel's name, Legarova, who are preparing to titter at a tawdry innuendo-reliant punchline, but we're better than that, and you should be as well. And yes, that's Prague by Muse playing under this, and yes, they suck, but it was all we could find. This week is, of course, always bad news for those of us who've never understood why Europeans want to live in the dark as well as the cold, as clocks are turned back, damning us all to another 5 months of the pointless self-inflicted misery of daylight squandering time. But a glimmer of good news on this front from Norway, where Minister of Trade and Industry, Iselin Nybo, recognising that 2020 in particular is a year many are keen to see the back of, at least apologised for adding an hour to it. With no in-house Norwegian available to voice the minister's remorse, here's the nearest thing we could rustle up. Monocle 24 and Finland's own Markus Hippi.
As Minister of Time, I strongly regret that 2020 will be another hour longer. This has already been a very demanding year for many.
If there isn't a moody and incomprehensible television series called Minister of Time already shooting in Stavanger, we don't know what's going on. And finally, good news for those of us who have long laboured to amplify the Florida man phenomenon, very often by locating an and finally item for whimsical topical monologues by lazily searching exactly that phrase on newswires. As aficionados will be aware, Florida man can always be relied upon to have recently been apprehended doing something undignified, ridiculous, and or inexplicable. Florida man's entry into mainstream discourse was sealed at the weekend when former US President Barack Obama, while visiting Miami, spoke of his successor.
That's not normal behavior, Florida. You wouldn't tolerate it from a coworker. You wouldn't tolerate it from a high school principal. You wouldn't tolerate it from a coach. You wouldn't tolerate it from a family member. Florida man wouldn't even do this stuff.
We now look forward to Florida man upon being bailed out following his latest shirtless, drunken altercation with an alligator in a Waffle House car park, suing Obama for besmirching his reputation by associating Florida man thus with the Sultan of Mar-a-Lago. For Monocle 24, I'm Andrew Muller.
Many thanks to Andrew Muller for that. And that's all we have time for today's programme. Many thanks to our producers Daniel Bache, Paige Reynolds and Carlotta Ribello, our researcher Charlie Filmer-Court, and our studio manager Maile Evans, with editing assistance from Sean Hickey. After the headlines, there's more music on the way, and The Briefing is live at midday here in London. The Globalist is back at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening. Have a great week.